Thank you very much indeed, Daniel, and thank you and the others for organizing this fantastic time here at KITP, which I'm already finding very stimulating. And what I want to do is to talk to you about outstanding problems in using spin states for practical quantum information science. And in thinking about this, I very much had in mind the aim that's on the website, that this program brings together researchers in these subjects to tackle outstanding questions in quantum information science. And again, later on the website, to foster collaboration and to resolve some of the outstanding problems. And there's a deliberate double entendre in outstanding, because they're both excellent problems and they're problems that are still open. And as the cartoons here indicate, I'm going particularly to illustrate these problems from the sort of carbon materials high up that we work on in my laboratory in Oxford. So that's what the focus will be this morning. But of course, nothing will please me more than to see that they may be applicable for implementations in other materials too. And I'll touch on some of the other material systems that we also use. So I could start by showing you a vision from about 10 years ago, which has inspired a lot of the questions that I'll be raising today. And now, this is a challenge in the technology, because what I want to try to do is to show you this animation here. So what I want you to imagine is that you've got, on an insulating substrate, a single-wall carbon nanotube which contains some spins, illustrated by these yellow arrows on a the red arrows on a yellow background. And imagine that you cool it down and apply a magnetic field so that the spins get aligned. And then imagine that you've got two sets of electrodes on this nanotube. There are these electrodes marked J, which are electrostatic and can control the interactions between spins through controlling the charge carriers in the nanotube between them. And then there are some other electrodes marked A, which work by passing a current through them, which then therefore locally change the magnetic field that the spin finds itself in, and therefore its resonant frequency. And now you can imagine that you could set the initial values of the spins. For example, if we're passing a current through A1, we can apply some microwave radiation, that was it, and that might change the spin, that might be a pi upon 2 rotation. And then we could address the second spin and apply some more microwave radiation. We'll make it 3 times as much this time, so that it gives a 3 pi upon 2 rotation. And now we'd like to be able to switch on and off the interaction between the spins, which we do with the electrostatic gate J2. So there are some electrons that can now flow between the two and create an interaction. We turn that off, and then we do another operation, for example, on the second spin. But how the second spin responds to the operation will depend also on the state of the first spin. And in this case, it's going to respond, and that could be the basis of a quantum-controlled NOT gate. And because this is built in a material system, you could imagine having a lot more of them, so you could continue the calculation further down the row. And you could go on doing that till you've finished your quantum computation, at which point you wrap up the quantum world and make a measurement into the classical world, whatever that means at a philosophical level, and get the output of your calculation. So that was the vision about 10 years ago. The very first open question, of course, is, will this ever be realized as a practical quantum computer? And that's an open question, but what is without doubt is the historical fact that this vision and other sort of related ideas have inspired a great deal of research, which have enabled us to learn a lot about the materials that might be used, and about how one might embody and manipulate quantum states in them. So let's close that there and go back to here. I can press the right button. And carry on. So what I'm going to do now is to show you some of the relevant experiments and calculations that have been done that might help you to evaluate how you could use material systems such as that for practical quantum technologies. And the first one is making little devices out of them. This is an illustration of it's actually an SEM picture of a device that was made by our collaborators in Cambridge, Mark Butelaar and others. And it's got a single-walled carbon nanotube here, which has been colored green to help you see it. And the electrodes here create two quantum dots. They also contain some other measurement capabilities that are not relevant for the results that I'm going to show you. And what you can do is you can measure the transport through the dots between this electrode and that electrode as you vary the potentials on these. And the particular thing that Mark was looking for was evidence of spin blockade, because then you're beginning to see the effects of a single electron spin on the transport in this device in these materials. And I won't go through this in great detail because it takes a bit of time to get your head around diagrams like this if you're not familiar with them, except to say that these are called stability diagrams. You're altering the potentials on two of the gates along the axes there, and you're displaying the resulting current in color. In fact, it's the derivative of the resulting color current. And the particular thing to look out for is the blue, which indicates negative differential resistance. And that is a good signature of spin blockade. And so a more detailed analysis of these data does indeed indicate that you've got spin blockade. And you can think of that as saying, well, if we've got one electron in one of the dots and the other and another in the other one, whether or not a current flows depends on whether they form a singlet or a triplet state. And in one case, having formed that state, the whole thing gets clogged up and no more current can flow until the combined state relaxes. So that's what we're seeing there. So we are seeing, in transport experiments, the effect of individual electron spins, or at least the combinations of two spins. And as we go through this talk, I'm going to flag up the outstanding questions, which I hope we'll find ourselves discussing, not only this morning, but at least for the remainder of my time here. And so the first question is, in these structures, and I'll explain in a moment what I mean by p-pods, how can you measure single spins? We know that the measurement of single spins is possible in other material systems. How can you measure them in these material systems? So, yeah?
How do you make sure that you're in a single electron regime in a double dot?
What, as opposed to having lots of electrons in the dots, do you mean?
No, I mean, how do you know that you're in a single electron regime? How do you have five there? We don't need at all. And you just need like an even, like an odd number of electrons there?
Well, the spin blockade regime itself depends on one spin in each combining to form either a singlet or a triplet state. You can do other experiments where you go on removing electrons from a double dot structure until the experiment stops working, and then you know you've got down to zero electrons, and then you can go back a bit, and then you know you've just got single electron cases.
Just because you don't get any signal doesn't mean you're in a zero electron regime?
If you plot those stability diagrams in other material systems, we didn't do it in this case, you can get to the point where you've no longer got any electrons in either dot, and then you can start filling up, and then you know you've got one electron. We did not do that in that experiment, or Mark Butelaar didn't do it in that experiment. and it doesn't actually affect the analysis of the experiment. So let me explain what a pea pod is. And a pea pod is a nickname given to a structure where you've got a nanotube, and we put inside it these carbon cages, of which the most famous is the C60 cage. As you know, a soccer ball like this has got how many black patches? Who knows?
12.
12? How many white patches?
20.
Yep. And how many vertices?
60.
Exactly. Brilliant. I'm very impressed by this knowledge. And so the most famous buckyball is the one.
Is the I just know.
Jens, every
year, but I have to look it up every time. Jens is absolutely dazzled by your knowledge. The most famous is has got 60 carbon atoms, but they're a rather versatile family, and you can put things inside them. These particular ones have got 82 carbon atoms, and they've got one cerium atom inside. And this is the cartoon, and this is an actual electron microscope. And this is a sort of electron microscope picture that a few years ago we would have been very proud of, because it enables you to see the walls of the nanotube. It's about 1.4 nanometers diameter. It enables you to see the C60 molecules, about 1 nanometer diameter. And inside each one, you can see one cerium atom. One of the things that's been quite astonishing in the last couple of years is the progress that has been made on electron microscopy of these structures. And that's illustrated by this movie here, taken by Jamie Warner. And now, there's your 5 nanometer bar. This movie is actually taken at 12 frames per second. It's taken at 80 kilovolts, which is a low enough voltage that there's no knock-on or negligible knock-on damage of the structure from the electron beam. And it's taken with a resolution better than 100 picometers, so sub-angstrom resolution. And some of those parameters I can illustrate in the next picture. So here's from a similar microscope study. I should say in that previous one, Jamie deliberately turned up the beam energy to make things happen, because then it's fun and you get nice movies. If you turn the beam energy down, everything stays pretty stationary. And this illustrates the kind of resolution that you can get. There's a carbon-carbon bond length. The sp2 carbon-carbon bond length is 133 picometers. And the pictures are readily resolving that, and you can see in the cartoons here that you're resolving the individual carbon-carbon bond separations. Something that's very important in nanotubes is to know how the nanotubes are wound up, because that affects not only their diameter, but also their electronic properties.
Is the carbon-carbon bond length so precise? You said 130.
Well, if you look up an sp2 carbon-carbon bond length in an sp2 bonded molecule, it's 133 nanometers is the textbook value.
Okay,
I'm not saying you can measure it to 1% precision in that particular picture, but what you can do is to resolve it. That's the important thing, and resolve it rather readily. By doing analysis like this and taking the Fourier transform, you can get the chiral index of how the nanotube is wound up, and therefore deduce its not only its diameter, but also its electronic properties. And something that I think you're going to see happening increasingly with these nanomaterials is the ability to do experiments on a device and to image with this kind of resolution by electron microscopy the actual bit of stuff that's active in the device. And this is real nanoscience, because a few atoms in different places can make a dramatic difference to the properties of the thing. And therefore, to be able to characterize the atomic positions with real space imaging is going to be a huge advance in being able to understand and develop such structures. And The second question that I've posed here is this, that some of the experiments that will be done on these materials in the near future is electrically detected magnetic resonance. Electrically detected magnetic resonance means that you're using microwaves to manipulate the spins in the materials and looking for the effect of that spin manipulation on the transport properties of the device. And EDMR is a phenomenological term. It just means an experiment where magnetic resonance of the spins changes the transport. And there's a whole family of different mechanisms that can give rise to EDMR. And in integrating the spin resonance, which I'll tell you about as we go on through the talk, with these devices, the key question is going to be, what will be the mechanisms that will give rise to EDMR in these material systems? And then the next thing I want to show you, partly because it's come up in some of the discussions already in the last few days, is the kind of, and there'll be a talk on density functional theory at 2 o'clock today, is the kind of materials modeling that can be done on these structures. These are calculations done by Linge under the supervision of David Pettifor. And these are actually, again, a cage of 82 carbon atoms with one scandium atom inside. There's the scandium atom, colored gold. And this inset here shows the spin transfer between the nanotube and the fullerene that's inside it. So green is positive and red is negative. So there's a transfer of spin from the nanotube to the fullerene. And then this is actually a calculation for the an isolated pair of these atoms in a chain, but not inside a nanotube. And again, you can see the charge distributions around the carbon cage. And the curve here actually presents calculations by three different techniques of the spin-spin interaction in a chain of these molecules. And along this axis here is the separation, the center-to-center spacing measured in angstroms. And up here is the spin-spin interaction per unit cell measured in millielectron volts. And what that calculation is essentially is that you take a ferromagnetic chain, so where all the spins are made to point up, and then you take an antiferromagnetic chain where the spins on alternate fullerenes point down and up, and you say, what's the energy difference between those two? And what you can see in this graph is that the energy difference is falling off pretty fast. And in simple terms, which turn out to be actually accurate in this case, you can think of that as a decrease in the overlap of the exponential tails of the wave function.
So how big are the spins now?
One Bohr magneton.
It's just one Bohr magneton? Yeah. Just one spin?
Yeah, it is because, it's different for each fullerene. What it is in scandium is that you've got three scandium electrons. Two of them go straight onto the cage with their spins opposite, so they're neutral from the point of view of this calculation. In most metallofullerenes, the third electron goes onto the cage. In the scandium case, it only partially goes onto the cage, and some of it remains on the scandium atom here. But you're left with one spin per fullerene that you're calculating. And there's a rather remarkable thing that's represented by these two arrows. These two arrows are calculations there and there for the chain inside a nanotube, so for this situation here. And what you notice is that on this scale, to the accuracy of these calculations, the nanotube has no effect on the spin-spin interactions. So the nanotube is serving the function of giving structural support and chemical protection of the chain, but is not otherwise changing the interaction between the spins. That was a slightly surprising result to us. And it leads to the next question. So this is the third of my questions, is is there going to be any kind of RKKY coupling in this case? In other words, is there scope for the coupling between spins on fullerenes in the chain being mediated through the electrons in the nanotube, which you might then be able to control? And I suppose in answering that question, I'd just go back to this one, this picture here, and say that this is a rather strong interaction. So this is rather too strong for most purposes. So we'd probably want to be out here, somewhere down there. And you can see that at that point, the resolution of these calculations has run out of steam. And therefore, the answer to the question on the next slide is not an obvious one just from those previous calculations. Now, what I want to do now is to move on to tell you about an absolute miracle molecule. So I've said that these fullerenes, you can put things inside, and there are various things you can put inside. You can put scandium inside, you can put yttrium inside, you can put most of the lanthanide series of the periodic table inside them. But you can also put column 5, group 5 elements inside them. So you can put nitrogen inside, you can put phosphorus inside, and I don't know whether you can put arsenic and antimony inside. I've not seen that done. And it turns out that for our purposes, nitrogen inside has slightly better properties than phosphorus, and it's a zillion times easier on the safety issues, so we just concentrate on the nitrogen. And the miracle is this, that if you've got 60 carbon atoms and a nitrogen atom inside, nitrogen is a very, very reactive atom. And the nitrogen-carbon bond is a very strong bond. So you would expect, just as we saw in the metallofullerene case, at least I would expect, the nitrogen to bond to the carbon chemically with a strong bond. But that's not what in fact happens. And what actually happens is the nitrogen stays inside this cage, behaving for all the world like a perfectly isolated nitrogen atom. And that means that you've got the opportunity to do essentially atomic physics in a condensed matter structure. It's very remarkable. And some of the results I'm going to show you now depend on understanding the atomic structure of the nitrogen at C60. And to a very good approximation, you can think of that as being the atomic structure of an isolated nitrogen atom. So you can imagine that, well, the nitrogen has a 3/2s electronic structure. So when we apply a magnetic field, you get a Zeeman splitting of the electron spin levels into 4 levels. Okay? Nitrogen 14, the dominant isotope, has a nuclear spin of 1. So you're going to get hyperfine splitting into 3 further levels there. And to first order of hyperfine splitting, the 3 blue arrows would all be the same length, the 3 green arrows and the 3 red arrows would be of the same length. But there are higher order effects which do not change the green arrows, so those almost stay the same length, but they do affect the blue and the red arrows. And you can see that in the electron spin resonance spectrum. So here's the ESR spectrum. And the first thing you notice about the electron spin resonance is that the lines are extremely narrow. And that's very good because it corresponds to very long coherence times. But now if you zoom in on them, you can see that this one here, which corresponds to these blue transitions, is split into 3. And this one here, which corresponds to the red transitions, is split into 3. And the green one is not split at all. Well, yes, it is actually. You can see that it is split there. And I've marked an extra effect with the asterisks. And the asterisks correspond to interactions with fortuitous carbon 13 atoms on the cage there. And the fact that these are so small is indicative that there's very weak overlap of the nitrogen electron levels with the carbon nuclei, but it enables you to quantify what you mean by very small in this context. I can see Art was looking very alarmed when I tried to pass over those experimental details. Yeah?
So what's holding the nitrogen inside? It's van der Waals forces, or?
It's a sort of snug fit. I don't know if you describe that as van der Waals. It's that the wave functions are very slightly compressed, and you can detect that because there's a very small shift in the hyperfine splitting. So these hyperfine splittings are slightly different from what they would be for a nitrogen atom.
Is that something is creating a potential for this nitrogen atom inside?
Yes. It's just slightly squashed. I don't know what you'd describe that as.
And what's the tunneling time out of the... I mean, it's very long.
It's very long, provided you protect it from temperature and from ultraviolet radiation, and also from chemical effects. So I'm not going to talk about it today, though I'd gladly discuss it individually. We've done quite a lot of work exploiting the fact that you can use chemical assembly on these molecules. And for the ones that contain nitrogen, you have to be careful, for example, not to bring an oxygen atom next to the carbon cage, because that's fatal for the nitrogen inside the cage.
But how would the nitrogen feel the oxygen?
I don't know the answer to that. I know it falls apart in the lab.
Don't you also have splitting of the light because they reduce symmetry into these green slot rotation symmetry?
Ah, let me come to that, if I may, in about two slides time, and I'll come back to it. That's a very, very important point. I'm just going to show you how we make this stuff.
So what's the typical size of this cluster?
It's 1 nanometer. So if you have one of these kissing the next one, and that will be a van der Waals kissing distance, then you find out 1 nanometer center-to-center spacing.
If you want to have the RP-Levy interaction, like what's the size of nanotube?
Well, nanotubes come in all different sizes. The size that these are a snug fit into is about 1.4 nanometers diameter. And what then happens is one of these comes along, and there's a gain in energy of about 3 electron volts, and that is a van der Waals gain in energy when the fullerene comes into the nanotube. And so that's how you assemble them in nanotubes. You have to be very careful with these because the standard way of making that is through thermal heating and sublimation. The nitrogen in C60 would fall apart under those conditions. So we overcome that by using supercritical carbon dioxide as a solvent.
So you argued that carbon-13 has a small influence.
Yep. And a measurable influence.
Is that argument based on the amplitude of the peaks? Or because it looks to me like
there's a shift.
Asterisks have a shift that's comparable to the shift of these other peaks.
Well, these shifts are very small, too. These are very small effects. We've blown it up a long way in order to be able to see that.
Are they comparable, or are they really, can you really say that the carbon is weakly coupled compared to the carbon?
Well, it's jolly weakly coupled compared to this. Because what, so this effect, right, is that much. Okay, and now we've really zoomed in. Most ESR spectrometers, incidentally, wouldn't resolve this detail. You need a very good spectrometer to see this.
But the small amplitude is probably just due to the small abundance of carbon-13.
You're quite right. The amplitude is the abundance, and you can work it out because it's got an abundance of 1.1%. So you can then work out if you've got 60 carbon atoms, how many cages of 60 carbon atoms will have one and only one carbon-13 on them. That's sort of schoolboy arithmetic. Okay.
I guess my question is, so you're saying still that the hyperfine coupling so the nitrogen is huge compared to the carbon.
Exactly.
But what is this other effect that's splitting that adds these three peaks?
Well, that's second order effects in the hyperfine coupling. So if you did a first order calculation of the hyperfine coupling, all the arrows of a given color would be the same size. Okay? And you can work that out by writing down the Hamiltonian. I mean, in simple terms, you can think that the hyperfine coupling is so much stronger than the nuclear Zeeman energy that to start off with, you neglect the nuclear Zeeman energy.
Yeah.
Then you need to include that later as a small correction.
Are these data from a small sample or single?
Yes.
So how many?
Oh, 10 to the 12, 10 to the 14, something like that. So for a bit of light relief, here's how we make the nitrogen at C60. This was an animation made for an exhibition at the Royal Society in 2008. So here's the apparatus. I hope you're not getting seasick from this. And what you've got here is in the base, we've got an oven from which we sublimate C60 molecules. On the right-hand side, we've got an ion gun, which produces nitrogen ions. And then there's a target at 45 degrees, which is cooled just to sort of 20 degrees centigrade with water. And the ion gun fires nitrogen atoms. And you're trying to make those hit one of these fullerene molecules that's being sublimated from below. And sometimes it hits the fullerene molecule and just smashes it to bits. But occasionally, a nitrogen ion hits the fullerene molecule and stays inside, and you get nitrogen at C60. And then what you do is you go, you know, you open the thing up and you scrape off this dirt, schmutz. And one of the great things about this field of science is that it's made soot academically respectable. And with a very laborious but effective purification process, you can extract the nitrogen at C60 molecules. Now, sorry?
How much would a kilogram of that cost?
We worked out it costs about $25 billion per kilogram. And a milligram is a large amount for us. It takes 3 months to make a milligram, roughly speaking. So now let's begin to look at the quantum properties of this stuff. And within the trade, the first questions that you ask are, what are T1 and T2? And if you think of, an electron spin as being a block sphere, like a globe of the Earth with spin up on the North Pole and spin down on the South Pole, and a quantum superposition state as being on the surface of the globe, and because it's got phase in it, quantum phase, you need to remember both the latitude and the longitude. And roughly speaking, you can think of T1 as being the time over which it remembers what its latitude should be, so whether it's north or south, and T2 is the time over which it remembers what its longitude should be, so whether it's east or west. And here are the T1 times, and you can see that as you get it colder, T1 gets better and better. It's got to in excess of a second by the time one gets down to about 4 Kelvin. That's not really a fundamental limit. You can go on making T1 better and better and better just by brute force with the temperature.
So what's the mechanism that controls this?
Well, you can see that it fits an Auerbach mechanism rather well down to about this temperature.
Sorry, what's
an Auerbach mechanism? Is a two-phonon mechanism. So you emit a phonon and absorb a phonon, and the difference in energy between the photons is equal to the spin flip energy. Down here, it's beginning to deteriorate, to depart from the Auerbach mechanism, and that may be due to a sort of jiggling motion inside the C60 cage, we think, which wasn't taken into account in the simple Auerbach theory.
What is the value of the Zeeman splitting when it's going to be working, like in Kelvin?
At 1 tesla, the difference in energy between an electron spin up and electron spin down for G equals 2 is 1.4 Kelvin. We're typically working at 0.3 Tesla, which is so-called X-band spectroscopy. But we also do W-band spectroscopy, where we're typically working at about 3 tesla. And later on I'll show you that this T1 time gives you a fundamental limit on the best memory time we can achieve using the best tricks we know. So this is an important graph to bear in mind. Now this one's also important because this is T2, and you'll see it's a very different scale. So up here is about 0.25 milliseconds. And what happens here depends on which transition you're looking at. So you remember the different transitions I had, and there was one which was the central line in the ESR spectrum, which all the hyperfine splittings were the same, so all 3 arrows were the same. And those are the black triangles here. So those follow this. The T2 time gets worse and then gets better as you cool it down. And then there's the outer transitions for the m equals plus or minus 1. This happens to be the m equals minus 1. And as you cool down, those get worse and just go on getting worse and never get better again. And then there's the inner transitions of the m equals minus 1 that are rather like the m equals naught line. Those go down and come up again. So let me just show you the on that previous curve what I'm talking about. So what I'm saying is that these green ones here, as you cool down, get worse and then get better. This one and this one and that one and that one, as you cool down, get worse and go on getting worse. But this one and this one are rather like the green lines. They get worse and then get better.
A question, I mean, the T1 time, I can imagine that, you know, when you go back to the level structure.
Oh, sorry, back onto that one, yeah.
That this can depend from which level you decay. Let's say MS plus 1
yes,
half,
yes,
and
yes.
minus 1 half
yes.
is different from plus 1 half to minus 3.
Yep.
And is that resolvable in your
No. Those all seem to be the same on the T1 curve.
That is somehow surprising. I mean, the energy difference there should matter.
Sorry?
The energy difference should matter.
Or what, the fact that these have different energies?
Well, I mean, if I decay from MS plus 1 half to minus 3 half, different energy of a photon being carried away compared, let's say.
Okay, but those differences are
cascades of decay.
Yeah, but those differences are small. You see, there are a difference in the fourth digit of the magnetic field here. So the difference in spin flip energy for this one is to within, you know, 4 figures, the same as...
I thought we were talking about the electron spin, and you said you had a field of 1 tesla.
Well, it's actually 0.3 tesla in those experiments,
Yes. It's 0.3 kelvin energy difference between 2 nearest neighbor levels.
Between this one and this one, yes.
So if you go from, next nearest neighbor to the next nearest neighbor, then it's twice that value.
What, from here to here?
Yeah.
Well, that's a forbidden transition.
Why?
Because it's
what is the mechanism, actually? I mean, there must be something in orbit which helps you to have a phonon-assisted spin flip transition.
Well, it is. It is a coupling to the vibrational modes of the carbon cage. It's a very weak coupling, which is why these times are so long.
Probably like quadrupole versus.
Is that a quadrupole? Yeah.
Is that to reduce 2
or? Because there's a very high degree of symmetry in the whole thing. So it's a very weak coupling, which is what we're exploiting. I mean, that's what we're benefiting from.
It's the spin coupling. You know, I mean, that the phonon itself cannot couple directly to the spin. So
yes.
Is it the moment or is it.
The probable answer to that is a phenomenon called zero field splitting. So what I want you to imagine is that this fullerene molecule, which, you know, ought to be the shape of a soccer ball, can undergo a distortion so that it looks like what we would call a rugby ball, and here you would probably call an American football or something like that. Pardon?
We just call it.
You call it a football. Okay, so it distorts from an English football to an American football. Okay. Now, that distortion carries with it something called a zero field splitting, which means that these energy levels split even in the absence of an external magnetic field. So as I've drawn it here, in the absence of a magnetic field, they'd all collapse. So in the presence of this zero field splitting, the zero field splitting does not affect an S, a half term. So S has to be, MS has to be more than a half for the zero field splitting to operate. So it will affect this one and that one, but not these two. So you can think that it sort of wiggles them up and down. And that's probably the coupling mechanism. And you can also now see why we get a different T2 for this transition from that transition. Same mechanism. But the zero field splitting just moves those up and down together, so there's no effect there. But it moves these differently and gives us the different coherence times in those transitions there.
I think to get some quadrupolar interaction, to get the zero field splitting, we also need to hybridize the S orbital with something else. So maybe this statement that Nate was making, that you break the symmetry, the rotational symmetry, just a little bit.
From that distortion I've just described, I think that's right.
If you have three unpaired electrons in S orbitals,
yep.
I don't think you can get any zero field
splitting. I think that's true, I think there's further evidence of that from this slight shift in the hyperfine interaction compared with an isolated nitrogen atom. So my guess is that we're hybridizing the S orbitals with some higher orbitals. Again, a very, very small effect, but you know, if you look carefully enough, it's probably there. So I think that's probably true.
As a matter of fact, it's also possible that two phonon processes can lead to T1 and T2 changes, even if the level is not split.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the Orbach type of process actually does contribute.
Yeah. Just wondering how to make the best use of the time. I may skip a topic now, which is a topic on, so let me just tell you in words, and if you're interested, I'll gladly show you the slides. But I'll tell you about it in words. We've got these, because then I want to get on to another topic. We've got these memory times here, and we'd like to do even better. And one way that we can do even better is to transfer the quantum information from the electron spin to the nuclear spin. The electron spin is very good for manipulating quantum information. It's good for propagating it. It's good for initializing it. But it's good for all those things because there are reasonably good interactions with the environment. The nuclear spin is not very good for all those things because it does not have good interactions with the environment. It's about three orders of magnitude smaller. But that in itself makes it extremely good as a memory. So you can then ask the question, well, can we get the benefit of both? And the answer is yes, we can. And we can transfer information from the electron spin to the nuclear spin. And we can store it there. And then we can recover the information from the nuclear spin back into the electron spin. And that way we can get two or three orders of magnitude improvement on the memory time. And the significance of this graph is that the memory time in the nuclear spin is controlled by electron spin flip processes. And you can see why that should be, because if I've got it stored on the nuclear spin, and let's say it's a superposition state on the equator of the block sphere of the nuclear spin, the appropriate rotating frame for that block sphere will be determined by the magnetic field experienced by the nuclear spin. And if the electron spin flips, then that will change the magnetic field experienced by the nuclear spin and cause precession and cause you to lose the memory. So you can see why the best memory time we could get in a nuclear spin is limited by T1. Turns out it's actually limited by 2T1, and to get that factor of 2, you have to work a bit harder than my simple hand-waving explanation. But now you can see that we ought to be able to get memory times if we use the nuclear spin right up in the sort of 1 second mark. And in fact, we've done that, and with phosphorus in silicon, we got it up to 2 seconds is the memory time. And these are in experiments where the time to manipulate the electron spin is measured in tens of nanoseconds. So you're getting that sort of ratio of, well, 7 or 8 orders of magnitude between the memory time and the manipulation time.
That's the nuclear spin of the nitrogen.
Correct.
Sorry, one very brief.
Yeah.
So I did this schoolboy arithmetic for the carbon 13, and it seems that about half of these things will have no carbon 13.
Oh, well done.
There will have one, and then the rest.
Well done. Yes.
So if you wanted to assemble these the way you were describing,
yeah,
to make a larger processor, would this heterogeneity be a problem, or is these shifts so small that you can basically?
It's not been a problem in any of the experiments that we've done so far, but there is an important point to bring out here, that many of the remarkable experiments on manipulating spins in quantum dots have been in the sort of materials that Art's been making for a lot of his life, the group 3-5 compound semiconductors. There are no stable isotopes of any of the group 3 elements, and there are no stable isotopes of any of the group 5 elements that do not have a nuclear spin. Group 4 of the periodic table is quite different, and there are stable isotopes certainly of carbon and silicon, which are the two that I work with, and actually some of the others too, that have zero nuclear spin. And you've only got to get your checkbook out to buy from the Russians isotopically purified ones that, you know, have even smaller contamination. So what that means is that if you ever got to the point where your experiments were limited by these constraints, you just get your checkbook out and buy isotopically purified stuff, and you can get rid of it. And so there's a real change in thinking in moving from these experiments in the compound semiconductors to these ones. In the compound semiconductors, people have got very clever at coping with the ubiquitous nuclear spins, and they've improved things greatly. In these materials, we essentially only have nuclear spins when we want them, and not otherwise. And that's a very big difference. So this is just the results of the storage time. I haven't shown you the details of how it works, but this is the decay in the fidelity of the electron spin echo, measured simply by its intensity in an EPR experiment, with time. And you can see that in this particular case, it's fallen to 1 over E after about 155 microseconds. We can actually do better than that. And here's where you transfer it into the nuclear spin and back again, and it's a different axis there. And then we'd increased in this case by about 2 orders of magnitude. And in subsequent better experiments, we've increased by about 3 orders of magnitude. So that shows you the kind of thing that you can do there.
These are the silicon phosphorus 6-1.
Sorry?
These are the silicon phosphorus 6-1.
Those particular ones were nitrogen in C60, but it has been done in silicon and phosphorus too.
I mean, I find now the time, 155 microseconds, surprisingly short. I mean, for this kind of
For the electron T2. Yes.
I mean, it's the same, you know, let's say in gallium arsenide, you know, the 3-5 material is the nuclear spin.
Yeah.
Has now 270 microseconds.
Yeah.
Echoing.
Yeah.
So what is the reason here?
The main reason there is because of a phenomenon known to metallurgists called grain boundary segregation. And those experiments were done in a solvent that crystallized, and the nitrogen at C60 go to the grain boundaries as it crystallizes, and therefore you get a bigger concentration, and so a higher spin-spin dephasing term. So it's a quirk of the way that particular experiment
was done. Reduce non-echo sounds, yep. single books. Yep. So I think Daniel's referring to CPMG experiments, right? related multiple existence. So we're considered a sequence of multiple existences.
Yeah, that helps you a lot if you're really trying to push things out, and if you've got worries about the fidelity of your pulses and your homogeneities and so on. I'm not sure that, I mean, we often use CPMG, and we also use a thing called BB1 as well.
Do you find a significant increase?
Yes, when you're really pushing it, yeah, yeah. I want to move on, and I want to tell you about quantum sensing. So this is, I want to tell you now really two topics that have come as a surprise to us in the last couple of years, that are different from anything in that original vision that I showed you. And the first of these topics is quantum sensing, and I'm only going to show you three slides on that. If you're trying to use magnetic resonance as a probe for a magnetic field, the way to do it is to tip on the Bloch sphere your spin into a superposition state, and then how it processes on the Bloch sphere will depend on changes in the magnetic field. So if you choose one rotating frame and change the magnetic field, it will process in that. And that's indicated by this phase term here, which is the precession under a change in magnetic field. If you create an entangled state, and here I've shown it as an entangled state of four spins, then you get a multiplication of that phase change by a factor of four, which you can measure. So now you can get an enhancement of the sensitivity to a change in field equal to the number of states that you've entangled, except that, to be honest, you should then divide by the square root of 2, which is the improvement you would have got anyway just by having more spins and averaging. And this is sometimes loosely called a Schrodinger cat state. And I do not propose to get into discussions now as to whether that's an appropriate description of it. And pardon?
Thanks for warning.
These sort of effects had already been demonstrated in optics. A difference between the optics and the spin case is that in the optics, the entanglement is usually created probabilistically, whereas in the spin case, it can be fully deterministic. And, you know, the speculation is that this might lead to new generations of sensors. So what can we actually do? Well, the first experiments were done with this molecule here. It's got a phosphorus in the middle and then three methyl groups. So you've got nine equivalent hydrogen atoms around the place. Sorry?
No,
sorry. And if you take an NMR spectrum, you get something like this red curve here. And now what I want you to imagine is that you're looking sort of end-on to this graph. And it's a graph in the complex plane, so that as we change the magnetic field slightly, these peaks will rotate in the complex plane as we make the measurement. And that corresponds to what you can do in the apparatus. And if what I showed you on the previous slide is correct, the further we go out from here, the faster they should rotate in the complex plane under a change in magnetic field. And these tiddly little ones here, which are blown up there, should rotate the fastest of all. And that should give us an enhancement in the phase change as a factor of, as a function of a change in the magnetic field, where the multiplication is governed by the number of spins that are pointing in the same direction. And to go rather quickly through this, here's the Fourier transform of the oscillations in these peaks as you change the magnetic field. And zero is up there, so the fastest frequency of change is down here. And indeed, as you go to the peaks further out there, so you get a bigger rotation of the phase when you have a change in the magnetic field. So it's demonstrated the principle. The problem is this was a nuclear spin experiment. And at experimentally accessible combinations of field and temperature, you cannot get the thing into a ground state. And there you have to, therefore, you have to be rather careful not to describe it as pure entanglement. You can do a little bit better by some tricks, which basically push the elements of the density matrix out there, and also use a bit of dynamic initial polarization. So here are some experiments that were subsequently done by Stephanie Simmons, and she's now used a molecule with silicon in the middle, so we've got 12 equivalent hydrogen atoms. And so the effect of that is that the signals out here are a bit better than they would have been with the cruder scheme, and they're rotating a bit faster, but it's still not as good as one would like. And so that leads to my next outstanding question, which is in this sort of entanglement enhanced sensing, can you think of a way to achieve a pure state to start off with, so you then could, with your hand on your heart, really talk about entanglement and get the full benefits of the scheme? There are other, some other outstanding questions about that, which I might raise later. Yeah.
If you have, in the setting of your type, the GLZ states, they enhance, of course, the situation as you described. But the other states who would do the same job and even better, is there a flexibility of looking at still mixed states, but like other multipartite states compared to GLZ?
I'd love to do that, Jens. And the answer is we haven't yet, and there might be some good mileage in that.
Okay. So, I mean, they're very good for pure states, but if you mix them,
yeah.
What is the purity of these molecules, I mean, of the states? I mean, what is the entropy per unit?
Okay, so there's a sort of question of personal pride, and then there's a question of the pragmatic benefit. The personal pride is, I would like to say, look, we've got entanglement enhanced sensing. But I'm conscious that the more alert people around the table might say, well, that's not really entanglement because you haven't got pure states. So that's the personal pride.
Depends on the purity, but
the pragmatic, the practical question is this, that if this is the one that's whizzing around fastest, we'd rather get that signal a lot bigger. Because then with a realistic signal-to-noise ratio, we'll reap the benefits of this entanglement-enhanced phase amplification much
more. But is it really the entanglement that's giving you the enhancement? So you're basically just post-selecting on these peaks, right? So you do get an enhancement in sensitivity,
and
you don't have entangled states.
Yeah.
So is it the entanglement that's giving you the benefit, or is it just the fact that you can post-select on?
Well, I'm careful not to describe it as entanglement because it isn't really entanglement, but it is the phase amplification of those states.
But can I comment on that? I mean, in the same way, it's an unknown whether it's a quantum computer that's promised to be separable at all times outperforms a classical computer. It's unknown whether you really need entanglement for this type of precision enhancement. So what the fair count would be, given a certain signal that you measure, how can you enhance that signal in what way or whatever?
Is it unknown, or does this prove that it's not necessary?
Because if you have a very big state there, then it reduces the signal. So the fair trigger pair would be like signal strength per resources.
Yeah.
I mean, this is not normalized for resources.
Well, and
he doesn't care. He just gets a bigger tank.
That's a very, very important question, is how you normalize it for resources. And particularly in the optics case, when people are talking about that, they usually normalize it per photon caught, per photon detected, all right? Now, you can argue as to whether that's really a good way to normalize it. Now, in this case, you don't lose spins, usually. So you dephase spins. You don't usually lose them. So whereas photons, you don't usually dephase them, but you often lose them.
But there is two kind of numbers that you have to consider, like the number of spins that you have at your resources and the number of times you want to address each spin.
Yep, all of those. But you can see that if we could make it so that all of it was in this state here,
right. So
this peak was much bigger, it would be a much better result.
Yeah.
And we'd love to be able to do that. Okay. And we might be able to do it with electron spins, for example. Let me whiz on, because I'm going to do one more topic, and then I'm going to stop. the last topic is storage in collective spin states. And this is a new topic that, in this form for spins, was only thought of just over a year ago. And there's a direct link to two talks that we've already had and one more that we're going to have tomorrow about these superconducting slit line cavities. And the everything I've been talking about up till now, you can think of as having the concept of storing one qubit in one molecule. That's sort of been assumed. But you've also noticed that actually all the magnetic resonance results have been on ensemble experiments. So there's a, you know, can we have the best of both worlds? Can we bring them together? And we'd also like to be able to do strong coupling to cavities, or at least enhanced coupling to cavities. And we've already seen, you know, in the last couple of talks, that coupling one Bohr magneton to a cavity is jolly hard and maybe impossible. And the idea now is that instead of putting one bit of information into one molecule or one spin, we put it into about a billion spins. Could be a billion molecules, or it could be some other material, and I'll show you some results with phosphorus on silicon. Now, when we came up with this idea, we were very excited and we developed it and we've gone a long way with it, only to discover that someone else had thought of it first in 1955. And here's Erwin Hahn as one of the authors on this paper, actually just before he'd moved to UC Berkeley. So he was already thinking of spin-echo serial storage memory, and he was actually thinking of it as a technological competitor for another kind of computer memory that was in vogue at the time, which was sending ultrasonic waves through columns of mercury. It was how people were thinking of storing information.
Is this all classical? Classical?
This is all classical information. And there are some very important differences between this and what I'm going to tell you. But still, you know, these were bright guys at that time, and they were having some pretty important ideas and some exciting thoughts. And you'll see in the abstract that he'd even thought how he could, this would be a practical storage mechanism for 100 pulses. And I'll show you that, I beg your pardon, 1,000, and I'll show you in a moment that we've done 100 with a related scheme. So we've still got a little way to go. Now, you can think of what I'm going to show you as a sort of quantum Turing machine. And this cartoon's due to one of our collaborators at Yale called Dave Schuster. So here is the Turing machine, and you know, here are the four key elements that you want for a conventional Turing machine, for a classical computer. So the way that we're going to do that is we've got a processor head here, which is a superconducting qubit, and in the Yale case, that's a transmon. And we've got to be able to talk between the processor and the tape, so that's a cavity interface. And we've got to have the memory, and this is putting all the information into the electron spin ensembles. And then we want a way of winding the tape backwards and forwards so we can choose which bit of information on the tape we're looking at. And I'll show you how we're going to use magnetic field gradients to that. And the scheme is this, that you have your ensemble of spins. Let's say they're in at C60 molecules, so there are other materials that would do. And we have one qubit in our superconducting cavity. And we let that be transferred into the ensemble. So in quantum terms, you can think that it's a superposition of 1 over root n times the qubit being in the first molecule and not in any of the others, so that's 1, naught, 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 plus it's in the second molecule, so that's 0, 1, naught, 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 plus it's in the third molecule, so that's 0, naught, 1, naught, 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 and so on, you know, for a billion of those. So that's how one stored it. Now, if you did nothing, it would superradiate back into the cavity. Indeed, an advantage of the scheme is that you get this enhanced coupling of the collective state into the cavity. But instead of letting that happen, we apply a magnetic field gradient. and turn it off. And what that does is to introduce a phase, a spatially varying phase in our ensemble. It doesn't need to be linear, but it's easier to talk about it if it is linear, because then you can describe it by a K vector. And then we can put another bit of information in, apply another field gradient, turn that off, and now that's got stored with a different K vector. And provided the K vector is big enough, then it won't super radiate back into the cavity, because there'd be phase cancellation, until you apply the reverse gradient and bring the bit of information you're interested in back into the K equals naught mode. And at that point, it'll super radiate into the cavity.
So is it like, for example, in the cavity you have basically a sample of molecules, right? And then there's a different layer of the molecules actually corresponding to different membranes?
No. Each bit of the information is in all the molecules. So people sometimes use the metaphor holography. In a classical photograph, one point on the object is represented by one point on the photograph. In a hologram, one point in the object is represented in the whole hologram in the phase relationships in the hologram. So this is the analogy of a hologram.
The thing is, how many degrees of freedom, collective degrees of freedom you have that can actually be used to store the information? Because right now you have superconducting liquids, right?
Yeah.
And you can give information to the cavity.
Yep.
The cavity can understand it through the sample, right? And the thing is, how many degrees of freedom
turns out to depend on whether it's an irregular or regular array. If it's a regular array, it's n degrees, where n is the number of spins. If it's irregular, it's root n. But since, in our case, those are so much bigger than anything we hope to achieve in the realistic future, the difference between root n and n doesn't matter for us.
If you have a big enough ensemble, then more or less for any kind of field gradient, the resulting set of basis states will be orthogonal to all your other basis states. So you don't even particularly need to worry about that. But if you obviously if you kept packing more and more information in, eventually these things will start to collide.
Yep. So let me show you some results. And the first one there are the four different elements put in, okay? So the first result is to show that when we apply a field gradient, we do eliminate the echo. So the experiment here is, first of all, you put the excitation in. You let a bit of free induction decay occur. You put a refocusing pulse, and you get an echo. So that's a simple Hahn echo experiment. Next, we apply a bit of gradient, and the amount of gradient that we apply, in other words, the integral of gradient times time, is increasing along there. And that's zero pulse size. So to start with, when you don't apply the field gradient, you get this much pulse. And then it gradually decreases and decreases until we get this. And in fact, the theory curve there is calculated for the particular geometry and so on. It's a bit like a Jink function allowing for the geometry. So what they're saying is that once we've got K big enough so that we're getting complete phase cancellation across the ensemble, we stop getting the echo until we then apply a second gradient, when, of course, we do recover the echo. If we apply a gradient, turn it off, then do an echo pulse and look for an echo, we don't get one. If we apply the gradient, turn it off, apply the echo pulse, and apply the reverse gradient, then we do get the echo. So the principle is working for one qubit. And the key thing I should say about these experiments is that the true single photon experiments need a lot more development of the experiment. So these are semi-classical experiments where what we're using is not a single photon but a very small tip angle. So it gives us a good indication of the kind of way we would expect the experiment to work when we do eventually do it with single photons. The second thing that I wanted to show you is, can we do it with two qubits? And the answer is we can. And there are actually four experiments represented here. The first one is where we distinguish between the two qubits by giving them either a plus X pulse or a minus X pulse. And then we, and the other one is we give them a plus X pulse or a plus Y pulse. So that's the difference between those and those. And here we want to say, well, can we do a memory where the first bit that goes in is the first bit that comes out? So this is a first in, first out experiment. Well, then can we do it the other way around? Can we do last in, first out? And the answer is that they both work. So we're now able to put two bits of information in and take them out in whichever order we choose. And then the...
But it's a classical bits of information.
They're small tip angles. It's a classical experiment. They're not yet single photons. That's still to come. And it will take quite a long time to get the experiments to work.
I'm confused. So do you... These things in solution?
These two experiments that I showed you here were nitrogen at C60 at room temperature. I'm about to show you somewhere it was phosphorus in silicon at cryogenic temperatures. It works for both of them.
But you're not storing any collective spins?
Yes, absolutely.
So how are the... So I would expect you have to have these things
right, no, no, just have them in a little tube. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So they're just in a little tube in the resonator of an EPR spectrometer. So those, as I say, were nitrogen C60. Now let me show you two more experiments which were done cryogenically in phosphorus. So these are phosphorus donors in silicon. And here was where Hua Wu, who did the experiments, wanted to see how many she could put in. And she's put in 100 pulses there, alternating them at random. And this is a last-in, first-out experiment, this particular one. So there's the 100 pulses going in, there's 100 coming out. And if you want to sit there and check, this region here, which is blown up there, actually does correspond, if you reflect it, to this sequence here. So you can get some idea of the reliability with which this is being done. And then the fourth experiment was to transfer the information, having put it into the electron spin states, then to transfer it to the nuclear spin states, so you can leave it there and get the benefits of the enhanced nuclear memory time, then to take it back out into the electron spins and read it out. And she put in a byte, 8 bits of information, and read out a byte. So there are the 8 bits of information that she read out, having stored it in the nuclear spin state. So my questions about that, and you can see I've accelerated a bit towards the end, is in these collective spin states, well, I haven't really explained these two problems. Let me explain them now. The superconducting cavities are very delicate. They have to work at tens of millikelvins, and we're working with single microwave photons, typically about 10 gigahertz. And the energy of a 10 gigahertz photon is very small, much less than an optical photon. Any realistic magnetic resonance experiment has to address the inhomogeneities in the magnetic field. And the longer you try to store stuff for, the more you have to cope with the fact that the magnetic fields are inhomogeneous and you get dephasing. And the standard way of doing that, which has been developed over tens of years, is due to one of the authors whose name I put up, Erwin Hahn, and you have the Hahn echo sequence. And the Hahn echo sequence involves essentially one photon per molecule, one photon per spin. So we're putting in a billion times the pulse size of the single photons that we're trying to deal with in the microwave strip line. And that's a very big mismatch, and quite apart from anything else, it's a big heat load on the cryostat. So there's a real question as to whether you could find a way to avoid using these refocusing pulses And what that means is there a way to cope with these inhomogeneities, the dephasing in the collective spin states that inevitably arise in any experiment? And then the other one, again, because I've accelerated, I haven't really explained the background to this. The whole point of these collective spin states is that they should be orthogonal. And if orthogonal, then they don't interact. So if you want to do any computing with them, you've got to find them a way for them to interact. And the way in our scheme that you would do that is by using a nonlinear Josephson junction device. In the case of the Yale experiments, their transmon. But you can see that's a bit of a bottleneck, because you've got quite a lot of information stored in the collective spin states. And what I'm saying is each time I want to do a two-qubit interaction, I've got to take one qubit out and put it in the transmon. I've got to have another qubit in the cavity mode, let them interact, and then get them back into the collective spin states. So there's a sort of bottleneck as to how you do that. And therefore, the question is there another way to do two or more qubit interactions and manipulations that overcomes this Josephson junction bottleneck? Well, you've listened terribly politely. I'm very grateful to you. I love this sort of interactive forum because it's what we're here for, but it does take longer to get through the slides. So let me finish with a nice picture of Oxford from the air one Sunday morning. And there are my outstanding problems in using spin states.
How big is the inhomogeneity you need to refocus against in percent?
Oh, I don't know the answer to that, but it's lots of pi's in terms of the Bloch sphere.
Okay.
So it's lots of rotations around the Bloch sphere. So it's not a problem that you can just hope it'll go away. It really won't. You have to address it.
Yeah, but if you think about avoiding refocusing, I mean, people do look at robust control, but they can correct offsets on the probably a few percent level.
Yeah.
We should probably talk about that offline.
I could look at. I mean, I could look at it because we just bought a magnet from Oxford Instruments, and that's specified in, I think, fractions of a microtesla in homogeneity, or right in a 0.3 tesla field. But it's still big enough that you've got to address it and deal with it.
It's actually wondering. I mean, in your nitrogen C60 molecule, you said before, when you talked about the T1, T2 processes, that there is some quadrupolar splitting or some effect which lets the phonon couple with the spin. But if you have actually such a mechanism, then in principle you have a pathway to couple electric fields. You know, phonon is nothing else. So you would have actually a way to couple such an nitrogen to the transmon mode,
yes,
to the electric mode. Have you made estimates how strong such a coupling?
No, I haven't. The one thing we have done, a calculation we did do along those lines, is that if you have a nanotube and you have a transverse electric field, you can modulate the band structure of the nanotube. But they turned out to be huge electric fields that we needed in order to produce a significant modulation. So it's not really an answer to your question, it's just what we have done.
I mean, it's a little bit surprising because, you know, the phonon field is just a fluctuating electric field in the environment.
Yes.
So if the phonon can actually dephase and relax you spin, you should also be able from the outside to experimentally access your spin.
So yeah, it's a nice thought. Yeah.
Very, very comparable field strengths, I think. Transmon has field strengths. I think they are comparable to field strengths produced by phonons.
You say the phonon, do you mean the phonon in the nanotube?
Well, I mean, there was this Orbach process relaxation. I don't know really where they are coming from. I mean, definitely they must come from an environment which is bigger than just the C60. I mean, the C60 could also have some phonons, but the nanotube would be a good source, I guess.
Wondering that is the correct level of doping has kind of a superconducting transition.
Yes.
So I wonder, first, have you seen this in this any kind of...
No, we looked for it. What did we do? We made some... So potassium at C... No, not potassium at C60. If you take C60 molecules and attach potassium to them, and then crystallize it, that's a superconductor. It's actually a rather good superconductor. It's got a TC of, I don't know, 15 Kelvin or something like that. So we thought we would try making P-pods of potassium-doped C60, but we never found superconductivity. It was a great disappointment.
But also, I think if you have 3 electrons per 660 or something, it has a superconducting position.
So if you have how many?
I think 3, I'm not sure, but 3 electrons maybe.
Yeah, we did try C60 with 3 potassiums on it, which would give you 3, but we didn't find it. It was an undergraduate project. I mean, we didn't work very hard at it, but it was fun to try.
A question to EDMR.
Yeah.
All your data were taken by this method?
No, we've not seen EDMR in the carbon materials. We've done EDMR in amorphous silicon. And we've done EDMR, we've actually done the highest field EDMR ever. We've done W-band EDMR in phosphorus-doped silicon. And that's been useful for checking that our EDMR experiment is working properly. And it was fun to do the first ever W-band EDMR. But we've not yet seen it in the carbon materials.
Did you try EDSR with these systems?
No, we haven't. Others have, but we haven't.
This is probably completely crazy, actually, but for the collective ensemble, if you have in homogeneities, could you go to like a circular cavity geometry and have the whole thing just rotating so you would average over the field as it goes around? Probably that would introduce...
But you wouldn't over.
More problems if we don't even...
You wouldn't overcome radial.
You can look at your kinetic.
Sorry.
You can look at your kinetic.
Or yeah, well, okay. I was thinking more like a ring, so the radial wouldn't be.
I mean, people do use, you know, they use magic angle spinning in solid state NMR. Okay, for every other purpose, the Hahn echo and the other more sophisticated sequences are fantastic, all right? So for all other purposes, you wouldn't want to replace them because they work so well, except for this problem of what do we do when we've got the superconducting cavity there. So that's a new problem that hasn't really been addressed before.
Well, I mean, it has some similarity to the Dickey model. Started. So you have a photon quantized in the cavity, which couples now to a collection of two level systems.
Yeah.
That's, you know, that's a Dickey model.
Yeah.
And now, you know, also when you mention super radiant effects, I mean, that means for the Dickey model.
Yeah.
I think it's just in the end the question of the coupling strengths between the photon in the cavity and...
Well, the coupling strength is adequate. Okay, we know that, partly because we've calculated and partly because we've started to do some experiments at Yale now. So we know the coupling strength is adequate. But the difference in the optics case is that in the optics case, the difference in energy levels is not dependent on the uniformity of an externally applied field. So you've just got some optical transition or something that you're using. So the difference here is that we're dependent on the Zeeman splitting, which is dependent on the external field. And we precisely want to be immune to, you know, we want a good phase memory. I suspect everybody's ready for lunch, aren't they?
Okay.